good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey, and we're going to be with you for the next hour. And the we being Tom Trabucca, Director of External Affairs for the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, known to the real world as the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan. And then at 10:30, Sean Riley from Federal Times is going to come on and give us his take about what's happening with the U.S. Postal Service, buyouts, and a variety of other things. But first to the Thrift Savings Plan. Tom, are you with us?
I'm with you, Mike.
Hey, thank you for coming on today. It's always an interesting topic. The TSP is so huge, it's hard to get your mind wrapped around it. What are some numbers to boggle us?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll run just a few by you. First of all, participation is fast approaching 4.5 million participants. That includes approximately 2.4 million FERS employees. There are still a couple of hundred thousand of us CSRSers who are around, 700,000 members of the Uniformed Services who have opened accounts since they were allowed to get beginning in 2002, as well as 1.2 million people who have separated from government service, most of them, I believe, retired, but who have still decided to leave their funds on account in the TSP. In terms of dollars, as of the end of July, we had $287 billion on account. Now, given the performance of the funds and the stock market in general over the past month, I expect that number to go down a little bit when we get the end of August numbers in. But nevertheless, $250 billion plus a substantial amount of money.
Now, investors participate biweekly. Their payments go in every 2 weeks. And military, I assume it's monthly now?
That's right. Military is monthly, although not everybody in the on the civilian side is 2 weeks. We still have people who are paid weekly, and we have people who are paid bimonthly as well as monthly on the civilian side.
That's right. I think the higher income, the cabinet secretaries and people like that are paid monthly.
I believe that's the case, and I know from personal experience that on Capitol Hill you're paid monthly as well.
Right. Okay. I've never been in that position. Tom, we had a couple of questions before we get to general talk here.
Sure.
A couple of questions from people, and one of them is extremely long, and we had heard from him before, and I obviously can't go through all of it, but he wants more choice, more agility, more flexibility. He said he'd like to have an oil stock, I'd like to have gold and precious metals, natural gas perhaps, but that he says the government is denying people the chance to, you know, be free and do it on their own and make more money and take risks. And I know there's a core of 4,000 or 5,000 people, many of them were characterized as day traders, who just have the feeling that this is not a very good system. Why is the TSP just as it is? It has, what, five funds? You have three indexed funds, a bond fund, and the Super Safe G fund. Then you have four or five target funds that are in essence funds of funds. Based on when you're going to start withdrawing your money, they become more cautious as you get nearer that magic date. But why don't you have more bold choices?
Well, this was a fundamental decision made by the Congress back in 1986 when it created the TSP as part of the Federal Employees Retirement System Act of 1986. As you'll recall, and I know you were covering it at the time, Social Security, mandatory Social Security, was extended to federal employees in 1983, and that precipitated the need to develop a new retirement system for employees hired after the date when mandatory Social Security coverage occurred, because the old CSRS is a full retirement program without Social Security. So at that point, Congress undertook an effort to look at plan designs out there and determine how they should redesign federal retirement to work in tandem with Social Security benefits. There were two different positions taken by the two houses of Congress. The House wanted, in particular, to just simply create a new defined benefit program that basically offset Social Security benefits. The Senate, on the other hand, was looking at what was going on in the private sector and the evolution of these, what were then new 401k plans, the savings plans that had evolved from Section 401k of the tax code. Senator Stevens, in particular, in the Senate, was very high on that. They came out with the approach that we have in FERS, which is a defined benefit program, which is about half as valuable as the old CSRS, plus the TSP. Now, the TSP went through extraordinary hearings, first forums and then hearings in the Senate to get input from industry as well as other stakeholders in the process. And through that, and these are all of record, all of these forum, what was discussed is, do you open it up and just let people have what was essentially a super IRA, which is what Donald Devine and the then Reagan administration was proposing, or do you have an employer-sponsored plan with limited choices? And the ultimate decision by Congress was to have the employer-sponsored plan with limited choices that could be added to over time. However, certainly at the beginning, and really it's been a guiding factor throughout, that these choices should be broad-based, passive index funds so that participants don't get into narrow investment areas. The notion of day trading was anathema to the Congress at the time, and another point was to make sure that the government was not endorsing particular investments. Rather, it was allowing its employees to get the benefits of broad market growth for their retirement savings investments.
And you have a tremendous oversight, don't you? I mean, a number of federal agencies, in addition to the Congress itself, oversee the TSP, don't they?
Well, that's right. And it's primarily the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor is responsible for overseeing pension programs in the private sector as well as the TSP. It conducts a program of audits of all aspects of the Thrift Savings Plan, operational aspects to make sure that everything and accounting, of course, to make sure that everything is above board. We have had over 200 audits completed by the Department of Labor and its contract auditors, Pete Marwick. You probably haven't heard of many of them, and that's because the audit findings were positive. They found that things were working as they should be.
I don't recall Greg Long or any of the executive directors leaving town in the dead of night.
Right.
So. Things are going good so far. Over the years, there have been a major push from industries and from politicians to add funds to the TSP, because this any fund that got into the TSP is going to do very well, because the government takes the money out, the government collects it for them, and then the government gives its employees a match of up to 5%. So it is a very good deal. You can see why people want in on it. But there have been efforts to have a gold fund or a precious metals fund. I believe there was a dot-com fund proposed by somebody,
right.
A minority business fund. And I guess the biggest push came from the real estate industry, the REITs, real estate investment trusts. And remember, we were told for several years there that they can't lose, that even if the housing market goes south, REITs are forever. And it turns out that's not the case.
Right, right. And that was an extraordinary battle. It went on over a number of years. It was actually not the first time real estate-related businesses had attempted to have a fund created in the TSP. The mortgage-backed securities industry back in the 80s attempted to do the same thing and put on a pretty heavy push involving Congress early on to try to get that done. There are a couple of things that any, you know, industry group would naturally do. I mean, what they want to do is promote their product, whatever it is. And certainly if the government chose their product as one of its select few investment alternatives in the retirement program it offered to its employees, that would be viewed as kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval on that particular product. So there's an attraction there, as well as you mentioned, the fact that these it creates enormous cash flows if you get into the TSB, because with 4.5 million participants, 3 of them contributing every payday to the TSB, their own contributions as well as matching, that's a pretty stable and guaranteed cash flow coming into your product. Fortunately for participants, and this was far cited by the Congress in creating it, board members who are responsible for developing and establishing investment policies for the TSP, and if new funds are determined to be desirable, as they were, for instance, back in the mid to late 90s when we sought the S fund and the I fund, Congress can and has approved them.
Tom, let me ask you about future plans. We need to take a short break here on WFED 1500 AM, but we'll be right back and pick up this point.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit MyVillageGreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Enzymatic Therapy and Nordic Naturals.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Please join me this week for my special guest, Spencer Mahoney, Regional Director, Southeast U.S. of the U.K. Trade and Investment Arm of the British government. He's going to tell us how to do business in the U.K. and how he can help you do that. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. Is this the year you're going to do it? Pack your bags for that trip of a lifetime?
The whole travel industry has been just exploding.
Dr. Stephen Krotzer is a travel medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic. If you're planning a trip overseas, maybe even to a remote or developing area, he says there's another trip you should take first, to your doctor's office and maybe a travel medicine specialist. You need to make sure you're fit enough to travel, and then there are the vaccinations.
The most important vaccines of all are just the routine ones.
Like diphtheria, tetanus, and the flu shot. Depending on where you're headed, insect-borne diseases like dengue fever, yellow fever, and malaria may need to be discussed. Dr. Krotzer also suggests medical evacuation insurance. It's relatively cheap, but can save you thousands if you need to be brought home because of injury or illness. For more information, talk to your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Vivian Williams.
Federal employees. With a 2-year pay freeze, rising health care costs, and potential changes to retirement annuity calculations on the way, recent financial events may have you concerned. First Command Financial Advisors understand the federal benefits system and can help you maximize the value of your benefits. Visit federal.firstcommand.com for an office near you and to request a complimentary financial consultation. That's federal.firstcommand.com.
First Command Financial Planning, Inc. Member SIPC and FINRA. First Command is not affiliated with or endorsed by the U.S. government.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
Tune in to Fed Central, dedicated to sharing insights and best practices on topics ranging from cybersecurity to sustainability to healthcare reform. Hear straight talk from government leaders and industry specialists on the issues that are shaping how agencies serve their mission and their constituents. Hosted by veteran broadcaster Jane Norris. Don't miss Fed Central, September 7th at 11:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. Sponsored by Deloitte.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
back to your turn. Mike Causey. I'm talking with Tom Trabucco. He is the Director of External Affairs for the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. These are the people that run your thrift savings plan, which he's now has 4.5 million participants, $287 billion as of July, and amazing money manufacturing system. Tom, the most recent additions to the thrift savings plan as far as investment vehicles are the life cycle funds.
That's right.
And as opposed to lifestyle, I was confused. But a life cycle means I say I'm going to not necessarily retire in 2040, but I'm going to be touching my money or start withdrawing it about that time frame. So if I want to, I invest in that, and it's a blend of all the other funds?
That's right. It's really an investment allocation machine, if you really look at it carefully. It includes all five of the TSP core funds, and the further away from the date in which you intend to begin withdrawing your funds, you are, the larger the percentage of the riskier stocks, the riskier investment choices, the three stock funds in particular. As you get closer to the time when you plan to withdraw your funds, it's automatically shifted back to toward a more conservative investment. There are two important things about this fund, though. Number one is the quarterly adjustment that occurs every calendar quarter. The fund gets less risky, but every single day, your risk profile is brought back to where it should be, and that's an important feature, I believe, especially in times like the past month when we've had a whole lot of volatility in the markets. You start every day with the same risk allocation if you're using an L fund.
Well, Alan Roth was our guest last week. He's a CBS Money Watch columnist, and he's a big fan of the life cycle funds. And he said because it makes you it does for you what you might not have the guts to do for yourself,
that is
buy low itself.
That's right. It's a very good point. It does force that discipline on you, and basically what it does is remove that weight from your shoulders, right, that you don't have to worry about doing that.
Right. Tom, for the critics who say there aren't enough investment options, is there anything coming up? Is there a window coming up when people will be able to invest, or is the time coming when people are going to be able to invest it outside of the TSP?
Yeah, there are two things I'd like to mention on that, Mike. First of all, we're well aware of various recommendations that are out there from participants, as well as others. We do look at this periodically, and for people who want to see our most recent review, and it's now 4 years old, but nevertheless, it's the third major review that we've done since we've existed. If you go to our business website, frtib.gov, there is a document there called Investment Option Review, and this is where we looked through a large number of potential additions to the fund back in 2006. To decide whether or not we should pursue them. So if people want to, your listeners want to take a look at that and learn a little bit about what we look for in these things, I'd recommend that.
Would that happen by an act of Congress, or could the board do it?
No, the addition of new funds can only occur by an act of Congress. That's set up in the law. In fact, the language is if more funds are desirable, the Congress can authorize them. But what the process that would follow is the fiduciaries, the five board members who make investment policy, and the executive director would review the executive director, by the way, is also a fiduciary, would review these options as we did in 2006, take a look and say, oh, we think that this one here would now be a good addition, and they'd put together a legislative proposal and send that to the Congress for consideration.
Is there sort of a format as to how what the end result would be? I mean, for instance, would the board, with the permission of Congress, pick a couple of mutual funds, a couple of vehicles, and say, we recommend these, they have low fees and whatnot, and then people could be able to, take money out of the TSP and put it in, or could they allocate some of their government salary to that?
There's two ways you can do it. In 1995, we sent up a proposal just to add two new funds. They were the Small Cap or S Fund and the International or I Fund. Congress authorized those, and then we began allowing them, and you could take money out of your existing allocation and move it over into the new funds or send your new contributions there. The second way it could happen, and Congress has authorized this but not required it, is that we could create what's called a mutual fund window, whereby people could take some of the funds out of their TSP to put it through this window to a separate investment platform from the TSP. We would make arrangements with an investment company that offers a wide range of mutual funds designed to do various things, whether it's you know, a high risk fund or a fund with big dividends, or all kinds of different ways you can cut that. And that mutual fund window would allow people to put some funds into that broader range of narrower investment choices. Now, anybody who wanted to do that would have to pay the full freight themselves for those more specialized.
That might be a rude awakening too, because some of these you have to literally make 3 or even 4% before you break even.
That's right, absolutely, yeah. So you have to really attend to those things.
The Washington Post, when I was there with our 401k plan, they gave us a chance to do that, and a number of people did. We did took some money out and invested it with, you know, Charles Schwab and vehicles like that. And as far as I know, and we tracked it pretty carefully, none of us did better than had if we had stayed with the company that the Post picked for us.
Right, right. But the point that people who support this type of thing say is, it's my money,
exactly,
and I want to invest it the way I want. So that is an option that's out there. But I will say this, when we had a vote on that at the board, it tied. The vote was 2-2, 2 in favor, 2 opposed. And then we discussed it with one of our statutory group, which is called the Employee Thrift Advisory Council, the unions representing federal and uniform services employees, the groups. And it was a mixed bag there as well. I mean, people do have somewhat of a paternalistic attitude towards this. I think in particular, after 25 years of success, they don't want to kind of toss out a design that has worked quite well in order to bring in something completely different.
I think one thing that truly benefited investors in all of this was the early input you got and keep getting from unions and associations representing employees. Because participation, as the last time I saw it, in the Postal Service is very high. And
yes,
you might not necessarily think that, but because of the heavy union endorsement and input, it's very high.
That's right. Absolutely. I heard some numbers from the National Association of Letter Carriers where 95% of their craft were contributing at least 5% under FERS. So that's an extraordinary number for what is essentially a big industry blue collar group there.
Right. It's an army, as they say, with one general and thousands of sergeants and privates.
Right. Right. And they have gotten the message. And remember, the postal unions are very familiar with negotiating pay and benefits,
yeah,
and they don't like to leave money on the table.
That's right.
They wanted to make sure that their people pick up that full match.
One of the great services they did. What about the Roth IRA option?
We are working on that. I will tell you, Mike, when we started doing this, I was, of course, talking to the folks in Congress about it, telling them that all of our people here are telling me this is a huge undertaking. And I must say, now that we're a year or so into it, it is a huge undertaking. But we are scheduled to roll it out in the second quarter of next year. We have currently, I mean, I know not a lot has been visible out there. That's because we're going through every one of our publications, every one of our forms, our computer system, and our regulations in order to put the package together that needs to be put together to offer Roth investments to everybody. It is a huge undertaking that touches every aspect of the TSP. And as you know, as big as we are, that's a lot of places to touch.
Right, and you do have to protect that people's tax safety too.
That's
in
right.
Doing something like this.
That's
so, yeah,
right. We can't have a mix up of pre-tax and after-tax money. It all has to run just right.
During the recent market troubles, did you have a big run? On, did people seek the safety of the G Fund?
Yes, they did. I figured you might ask that question, so I asked for some daily numbers looking back. And I see that back in at the beginning of August, when things were really shaken out in the market, let's see, on August 3rd, we had 12,000 interfund transfers. By the 5th, that had gotten up to 25,000. On the 5th, 27,000. On the 8th, 25,000. On the 9th, then they tailed off again. So there's always some movement when the markets go like that, but and these are big numbers. Normally, we have between 4,000 and 10,000 interfund transfers in a day. But the thing I will point out is, even though it's 25,000 people moving money on any given day, 4.5 million of our participants could have moved their money that given day. So the vast majority, 99%
stayed the course.
Stayed the course. That's
Tom Trabuca, thank you so much for being with us. It's very helpful, very interesting with the TSP. We'll get you back on here. Thanks. We're going to take a short break here on WFED 1500 AM. Be right back talking with Sean Riley from the Federal Times.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma, one of the great stars of classical music, enthralls audiences all over the world with his passion and artistry. When it comes to picking a cello, he tends toward Italian instruments made in the 18th century. When it comes to a timepiece, however, he favors an instrument crafted in Switzerland, the Rolex Datejust. Since Rolex introduced the first self-winding calendar wristwatch in 1945, the Datejust has become one of the most sought-after models in the Oyster line. With its classic Oyster design and magnified date window, the Datejust is every bit as distinctive as the master cellist who wears it. To see the Datejust and a complete selection of other Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Retirement is expensive. You may need 70 to 90% of your pre-retirement income just to maintain your current standard of living. So how do you protect the money you've already saved from market fluctuations? How do you make sure you won't run out of money? Hi, I'm Mark Tabron. We'll tackle these questions and more every Saturday morning at 10:30. Learn how to protect and grow your money with me, Mark Tabron, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Can't wait till Saturday? Then call me today at 301-773-3923.
They gave a part of themselves, sacrificed for our freedom. The brave men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces, wounded in action overseas. Now it's our turn to give as they return home. So join the GTSI Charity 5K Run Walk in Herndon, Virginia on October 15th, benefiting the Wounded Warrior Project, providing much-needed direct programs for injured veterans. For race information or to register online, visit GTSICharity5K.com or visit them on Facebook at GTSI Charity 5K.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Can you find anything on the internet? Well, I'm sure you can, but don't take my word for it. Just ask this talking dog who can only say I love you. Roll the clip. One more time, talking dog.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
The nation's largest intelligence event of the year returns to San Antonio, Texas, October 16th through the 19th. Network with professionals from the defense, intelligence, and homeland security communities at the GEOINT 2011 Symposium. USGIF's GEOINT Symposium features keynote speakers from agencies, combatant commands, and Congress, as well as panel sessions and breakout tracks tackling the critical issues affecting national security. Register now or learn more at GEOINT2011.com. That's GEOINT2011.com.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Concrete, the most widely used building material in the world, can crack, say in an earthquake.
so engineers are working on a concrete that heals itself. Concrete is made by mixing cement, water, sand, and rocks. M.R. Hansen, a South Dakota School of Mines and Technology civil engineering professor, wants to alter that mixture a bit, replacing some of the sand with a porous material that absorbs and stores water and keeping in bigger particles of cement.
The main thing is don't grind it quite as fine, and we can control that.
A final touch might be
some additive to the water that would make it travel through the cracks more easily.
Then when a crack occurs, the stored water would leak out, activating unused cement in those larger particles to seal the cracks. It could not only restore structural strength, but save time, money, and materials. To find out more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm going to be talking with Sean Riley. He is a senior reporter with Federal Times, and get their perspective on what's happening in the government, which is a lot. Sean, are you there?
I'm here. How are you, Mike?
Thank you, sir. Glad to have you. A lot of things cooking, and I know you wanted to talk about what's going on in the Postal Service, this second largest federal agency, and all manner of things are being proposed, including major downsizing.
That's right. As we've talked about before, the Postal Service a couple of weeks ago unveiled some proposals to essentially take its workforce out of the federal employees' health benefits programs, create its own retirement system, and also get the freedom to lay off up to 120,000 employees. You know, all of those steps would require congressional approval. But one thing the Postal Service can do on its own, it's now apparently proceeding with, is to close down about 300 mail processing plants around the country, which will eliminate between 30 and 35,000 jobs in the next year or so. And that, you know, that's probably one of their biggest single downsizing moves ever. And although a lot of, you know, the career workers are, I believe, protected by union contracts, they, you know, in some cases could have to, you know, face being reassigned to another plant, which could be a long way from where they live. So it's a very significant step.
Well, I wonder, I haven't seen the details of their master plan, but this idea of going it alone with a Postal Service health plan, presumably that would cover their 600,000-700,000 employees, however many they are left with, mm-hmm. plus several hundred thousand retirees. And I wonder if they're aware that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation did that about 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. They said they could do better on their own and get out of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. And within a couple of years, they were begging to come back in and had Congress request that they come back in. And this was a small, well-financed agency with high-paid employees, presumably not particularly dangerous jobs or unhealthy jobs, and yet they opted to come back in.
That's fascinating. I don't know whether the Postal Service is aware of that, but you would think it would certainly be a lesson that they want to study if they plan to seriously pursue this this idea.
Can you do you know what the stated reasons and maybe what the unstated, the hidden reasons are for wanting to have their own health program and have their own retirement?
I think it's essentially to save money, particularly on the health care side. The Postal Service is now required to pay each year about $5.5 billion, what's called a prepayment, into their its retiree health care fund. And this is money it's not needed to pay the immediate coverage needs, but it's to make sure that the Postal Service in the future has enough money set aside so it can provide insurance coverage for, you know, what's going to be an enormous, what already is a very large retiree population, and it's only going to get bigger. And this has been this was required in a 2006 law called the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act. It's been a huge irritation for the Postal Service. They say that no other company, no other federal agency faces a similar requirement. And in this case, their next payment is due exactly a month from today on September 30th, and they say they won't be able to make any of it. So that's a big part of what they want to do, why they want to create their own program. The way it would work is, the Postmaster General explained a couple weeks ago, is that Medicare would become the primary coverage for retirees, and the Postal Service's plan that it would create on its own would become a backup, and that would save them a lot of money. So they're quite upfront about that, but I think also they want to get out from under the burden of this legally required health care prepayment.
And as you say, the other federal agencies don't have to do this. There's a pay-as-you-go.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And they say they're essentially being singled out, and that if it were not for this requirement, that they would basically have been profitable the last few years instead of hemorrhaging billions of dollars.
Yeah. Now, what about the being a self-insurer, if you will, a self-retirement plan? What's the advantage of that for the Postal Service?
I'm not sure of the ins and outs. I think what they would plan to do is essentially put it out for, bid it out and create their own nationwide network. Whoever could meet whatever the requirements are at the lowest cost. And I guess the advantage again would be that they'd be spending less money than they are now through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program.
And it would be in effect a private insurance company, I guess. Huh?
I guess I'm not an expert on this, so I don't know. But yeah, I think it probably would be run by one of the Blue Cross Blue Shield companies, whoever could do what they wanted for the best price.
It would be interesting to know the take of some of these private companies to see if this is something they jump at or if they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I keep thinking the Postal Service at one point had a higher disability retirement rate than the Marine Corps. And, this because it's an industrial operation, mm-hmm. And although with a lot of jokes about dog bites, that's a very mm-hmm. serious problem.
Oh, yeah. No, they have a lot of, I've talked to service employees who work some of the sorting machines, a lot of repetitive motion injuries. So the interesting question, there are just so many aspects of this, these proposals, they've yet to be explored. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee has set a hearing for next Tuesday afternoon. Which the Postmaster General Patrick Donahue is going to be speaking along, I think, with representatives from labor and mailing industry groups, and it'll be very interesting to see, to how much flesh he can put on what right now is a fairly sparse proposal.
Yeah, and the Postal Service, I know the American Postal Workers Union has been running ads that make the point that they do not get federal funds.
Mm-hmm. That's true. They get a tiny bit of money for essentially, I think, serving the blind.
Mm-hmm.
Basically they are self-supporting. Retiree health care prepayment requirement was put in, I think the concern was that, given, as you noted, there being the second largest federal agency, is that they could, in the long run, end up requiring a bailout from taxpayers, again, to cover health care needs for retirees in the future, and that's what they wanted. That's what Congress wanted to avoid, at least when they passed the 2006 law.
Yeah, and boy, it was such a different. This was before email and Twittering and tweeting and all that.
Yeah, what the Postal Service told me at the time, they thought they could, they knew it would be tough to make, to meet the requirement, but they thought they could do it. But
mm-hmm.
they definitely have changed their mind.
Yeah, that's gone. What about this super committee, this bipartisan, bicameral committee on Capitol Hill that's going to take a look at the federal, take a look at everything, but try to find ways to cut spending, and many people say that the federal community is going to be hard hit by them.
They're really just getting started. I think they hired their staff director, announced the hiring of their staff director yesterday. It was a very important person, and was generally, positive sign. It was greeted with bipartisan praise. But yeah, I think that, certainly federal benefits will be on the table. We have the proposal out there to go in terms of determining what your pension will be, going from a high 3 to a high 5. I was talking to someone earlier this week who said that could very likely happen. You've got the continuing pressure on pay. You already got the pay freeze in effect. So certainly, there's and who knows where exactly they're going to go, but I think among people who follow this, I think there'd be some surprise if federal compensation weren't in some way affected by what they eventually recommend.
I want to get into some more detail with that after we come back on break here at 1500 AM.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. Located in the upper right chamber of your heart is something called the sinus node. It's your natural pacemaker. Abnormal inappropriate sinus tachycardia is when something triggers the node to make your heart rate race over 100 beats per minute.
This is a problem that tends to start in more than half the people after some kind of profound illness, usually a viral illness.
Dr. Stephen Hamill is a heart rhythm specialist at Mayo Clinic.
When it's an abnormal rhythm, usually the heart is an innocent bystander to something that is increasing the amount of adrenaline in the body, and the heart rate is driven faster because of that.
When that's the case, treating the tachycardia means figuring out the cause. Dr. Hamill says rarely the problem is with the sinus node itself. For more information, talk to your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Vivian Williams.
Here's Christopher Lowe, Associate CIO, USDA's Agricultural Security Operations Center, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by HP Enterprise Services.
Another challenge is just the overall fluidity, whether it's clouds on the back end or mobility on the front end, the shadow IT of my own personally owned device brought into the agency, or the customers wanting to use whatever it is they're bringing to bear at that time. We need to be able to do what we need to do when we're doing it, and our application development isn't there yet.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezor Media Group, log on to Federal News Radio.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective. And that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. Learn more. Visit hp.com/go/cybersecurity.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Survey data shows that most Americans sit for the majority of the day, as much as 8 to 10 hours.
We think that that much sitting takes away from other kinds of activities people do in their daily life, and that loss of activity may be an important component to the mortality risk reduction that we saw in our study.
NIH investigator Dr. Charles Matthews took data from the NIH AARP Diet and Health Study.
In addition to exercising at recommended levels, reducing sitting time when possible appears to be an important component to a healthy lifestyle, or certainly extending longevity.
For details, visit the website dietandhealth.cancer.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Federal employees. With a 2-year pay freeze, rising health care costs, and potential changes to retirement annuity calculations on the way, recent financial events may have you concerned. First Command Financial Advisors understand the federal benefits system and can help you maximize the value of your benefits. Visit federal.firstcommand.com for an office near you and to request a complimentary financial consultation. That's federal.firstcommand.com.
First Command Financial Planning, Inc. Member SIPC and FINRA. First Command is not affiliated with or endorsed by the U.S. government.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Sean Riley from the Federal Times, and we were discussing the this super committee or super congressional commission just appointed its executive director, he said, or his staff director, and they're going to be coming up with a variety of proposals for ways to cut federal spending, cut programs, presumably make money and tax revenue and all that sort of thing. John, you know, this thing, this reminds me of Hurricane Irene. We knew the components for the hurricane, mm-hmm. how fast it was going, the speed of the winds, what would happen if it went certain directions, what would happen if it passed over land. And yet at the end, I guess for us, certainly in the Washington area, it wasn't as bad as we had anticipated and been led to believe. Now, this is no comfort to the 270,000 people who are still without power. But, you know, it wasn't Armageddon. And when it hit Manhattan, there was predictions it would blow out the windows in the top floors of skyscrapers. That didn't happen. And yet nobody anticipated covered bridges floating away in Vermont. I mean,
mm-hmm.
who thinks about Vermont and hurricanes? And it's something like this has been happening with this deficit reduction plan. We first had the Simpson-Bowles Commission appointed by the president that was supposed to solve the situation. It didn't. Then we had the vice presidential, the Biden Commission, or the Biden group out of the Blair House,
mm-hmm.
And that was supposed to solve the problems and didn't. But both of them contributed ideas to the debate, and now I guess this is a last-ditch effort to force the Congress to do something, to make some really tough, politically unpopular spending cuts, and by timing it so that they'll get their report sometime after Thanksgiving, have to act on it, presumably starting in December. What are some of the forces at play here? If this is like Hurricane Irene, what are the components for this?
Well, the overall component, and you're right, it's going to be, there's no real precedent for this, so it's very difficult to say, you know, predict exactly what might happen. But obviously, you know, there is the desire to, you know, to cut spending, and to do it in a way, that bypasses the normal political process, since clearly those mechanisms haven't really worked at this point. But so the idea, though, is essentially to force Congress's hand that, you know, this super committee, you know, will report its recommendations, or supposed to, by Thanksgiving. Congress has to act on them just before Christmas. If Congress doesn't, you know, if that process breaks down, then you'll have automatic cuts, known as sequesters, taking place over the next 10 years, and half of those would be $1.2 trillion total by 2021. Half of those would come out of defense, and presumably the idea is, since lawmakers and presidents are leery about slashing defense spending, is that this will be an incentive, I guess you could call it, for Congress to actually, for the super committee and Congress to, you know, to take that route as opposed to submitting to automatic cuts.
And I guess some of the things that are in the, that are on the list of the things that might be proposed as cuts, the one you spelled out, I believe, last week about reducing or making employees contribute more toward their retirement,
yeah,
whether they're FERS or CERS.
Right. Well, that was, I know it's, we had one thing that may give and I give, offer some clues to how the super committee might proceed. If you recall, back in July, there were discussions between the President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner over a so-called grand bargain, quote unquote, that would have reduced the deficit by about $4 trillion. And apparently a couple of the ideas which would, you know, the deal fell apart at the last minute because Republicans wouldn't agree to, didn't want any revenue increases in there. But apparently some of the elements in that plan, had it gone through, would have included big increases in what federal employees would have to contribute, at least to FERS, would have been up from, I think it's now currently 0.8% of salary to about 6%. And then civil service retirement systems employees also would have had to contribute not quite as much. And that should say would have been that increase would have applied to new federal employees, and then current FERS and CERS people already in the system would have also seen an increase, but not as large. Their rates would have increased by about 0.5% each year for 3 years once the current federal pay freeze ends. So that was something that apparently had the agreement had been signed off on both by the White House and by Republicans in Congress. So it might not, you know, may not be surprising to see it come back in some form. anymore.
That's very significant. If they had agreed to that and it was just the reluctance of the Republicans to vote for any tax increases that, mm-hmm. that blocked that, if you had the White House and the Republican leadership in the House. The other one, this so-called chained cola, which would change the yardstick they use mm-hmm. to measure inflation, that right. would cut into future benefits, wouldn't it?
Right. That would affect the size of the COLAs, I think, by about 0.25 percentage point, I guess, per year. So it's not enormous, but it's still real money.
And when you apply that, the civil service savings would be significant, but when you apply that to Social Security, one out of every six Americans gets a Social Security check now, mm-hmm. and if you can reduce that check, mm-hmm. Reduce the increase in it over a period of years, that's a tremendous savings.
That's a very good point. I mean, just because the base is so large, any reductions overall cumulatively amount to a lot of money.
Right, and the other thing, and I say this not to be flippant, but it is so, the current system is complex enough with the CPI and the urban wages and what's measured and what's in and what's out.
Mm-hmm.
But this change CPI is more confusing yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard to explain. It would be hard to oppose. I mean, you just say, I'm against it, but you'd be hard pressed to say why you're against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of men, I would certainly have trouble explaining
yeah.
it. And I think a lot of, you know, even members of Congress would have difficulty, selling it to their constituents or explaining exactly how it differs from the status quo.
Now, what about the health insurance premium? Wasn't there talk of making people pay a bigger chunk of their premium over time?
That I'm not sure of. I mean, generally, I think the trend is up, obviously, but whether there was anything specific in there that would have, you know, accelerated those types of increases or, you know, magnify them over time, I don't know.
I believe the National Active and Retired Federal Employees said that there was a provision, and again, I forget in which, or maybe it was just part of the discussion, but the idea would be that each year, the amount that federal workers and retirees contribute to their health plan, which is now about 30% on average,
mm-hmm.
it would go up. And I believe wow. NARF said that over in a not that long a period of time, 5 or 6 years, the amount could go to between 50 and 56%. So that
wow.
would be a sizable chunk of the premium.
Yeah, sure is. I mean, that would take a, and then, you know, essentially that, you know, as with an increase in your pension contribution, your FERS contribution, that essentially amounts to a pay cut.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what about the pay freeze? We had 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
The Bowles Simpson Commission proposed a 3-year cut.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama said, I'll go along with two, and
mm-hmm.
he proposed that. But there's been talk of a freeze lasting up to 5 years, hasn't there?
Well, I think there is. I believe actually the president may have proposed that. But, yeah, going, I think, up to 2015, I think. But, yeah, I think I would not be surprised at all in any case if there is an extension, at least on, you know, the on base pay for, you know, for another couple of years.
Yeah, I know you wanted to talk, too, about this, what do we call this, the performance.gov.
Oh, yeah, this is a big initiative of the Obama administration's. It's the sort of the keystone of their performance improvement system. Essentially it's a website, as you might imagine, that was created about a year ago to consolidate information from agencies on how they're doing in meeting performance goals. And until last week, actually, it was open on a password-protected basis only to essentially federal employees. The administration made at least some of that information public last week, although it's not you could say it's definitely still a work in progress. So they acknowledge it'll grow much richer over the next year. But it is aimed at consolidating performance information across the government. Earlier this year, the president signed a law called the GPRM, the Government Performance and Results Modernization Act, which is an update of the main federal performance law passed almost 20 years ago, and that required setting up a government-wide website, again, to track agency performance over time.
You know, you'd think with the emphasis on transparency, they would be opening this up, but I'm going to have to break it here. That's how transparent we're being. Thank you very much, Sean Riley. We'll talk to you next Wednesday, and we'll hope to see you all back here next Wednesday. Have a good week, and buckle up.
You too, Mike. Thanks.